This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. It's the show where we break things up and address a few different topics. Coming up, Indiana's independent music venue owners speak up on the impact of the pandemic on their industry. A new alliance aims to keep them afloat. We'll tell you about a special live stream benefit happening on Sunday. And later, the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site in Indianapolis has been 3D scanning some of the most noteworthy artifacts for you to peruse from the comfort of your home while you're in quarantine. But first, a quick look at the state's biggest headlines with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer and one of the few people still going into the office these days, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing okay, but we hit a big milestone this week in the number of deaths from the coronavirus in Indiana. Let's take a look at the latest numbers.
Yeah, so we hit 1,500 deaths in the state, and that's not including presumed positive deaths, so folks who died before they received a COVID-19 test, but medical professionals within a reasonable shadow of a doubt, it can confirm that they probably had COVID-19. So including that number, we are in about the 1,600 range. But for confirmed deaths, as of noon, we are at 1,550 dead, more than 26,000 confirmed cases, and more than 165 tests have been done.
165,000 tests?
Yes, 165,000 tests, which is about 35,000 tests over the last week. So testing has really ramped up. And the state also launched its privately run contact tracing center on Monday with Maximus Inc. It's part of what Governor Holcomb's administration has pointed to when asked why we are comfortable reopening parts of the economy at this point. And State Health Commissioner Chris Buck says information gathered by the state contact tracing call center remains private. The call center has already contacted hundreds of people to trace the spread of COVID-19. And Buck says that private information will never be shared during those tracing calls.
And do we know kind of a little bit about how this contact tracing works? I understand that some of the tools being implemented involve using cell phone data. Do you have the basics on that, or has that not been really talked about a whole lot?
Yeah, the contact tracing center itself is basically after a person is diagnosed as positive for COVID-19, they are... This contact tracing center reaches out to that person and basically says, hey, you know, we want to try and figure out where you have been and who you may have infected over, you know, the 14 days of shedding the virus. And so then they go through that point and then start to reach out to folks to let them know, hey, we have reason to believe that you may have been exposed to COVID-19. Maybe you should quarantine, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow, that sounds like a big lift, but I'm glad it's being done. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at the education world and some guidance that came down from the federal level this past week. What did we hear?
Yeah, so U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos provided guidance to public schools on how to share funding from the CARES Act with private schools in their district. And she did that April 30th. As written into the Federal CARES Act, financial support from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief, or ESSER fund, is supposed to go to schools, public and private, based on their number of low-income students, also known as the Title I formula. But the new guidance that she sent out at the end of April contradicts that idea and says the limited pot of funding going to school districts should be shared with private schools based on total enrollment instead. And so the state estimates that that would make approximately $15.4 million accessible to private schools in Indiana. That all happened, and some of the backlash to that happened at the end of last week. This week, however, the Indiana Department of Health rejected that guidance. The department is telling school districts to ignore it and follow the language in the CARES Act.
Or rather, the Indiana Department of Education.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Indiana Department of Education. And it means that districts receiving emergency funding will share with private schools based on their number of low-income students instead of total enrollment. And according to the memo, the Attorney General's office weighed in and describes the federal guidance as just that, guidance. Okay. So with districts using the original interpretation of the federal law, that leaves about $4.9 million in emergency funding available for private schools across the state.
Okay. So, all right. So Indiana doing its own thing, I guess, in respect to these guidance, this guidance coming down from Betsy DeVos.
Or at least sticking more closely to what the language of the CARES Act is, right? You know, Betsy DeVos has spent the majority of her tenure as the U.S. Education Department Secretary, opening up funding to non-public entities. And so that seems more like a pullback from the State Department. I think other states are doing the same thing.
Okay. And what have utility companies in Indiana said this past week about their impact from the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah. So several gas and electric utilities in Indiana are seeking financial relief because of the virus. The utilities say that they're losing money because building closures have driven down the demand for energy. They're also paying extra for things like protective gear and employee overtime. And many have stopped disconnections and late fees to help out residents unemployed due to the pandemic. The utilities have asked the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission to let them defer some of those costs and track them so that they can be recovered at a later date, possibly by increasing rates. Now, on the flip side of that, the state's consumer advocate group is asking that same commission to continue protections for people unemployed due to the virus. And among other things, the group wants that commission to order utilities to continue suspending disconnections past June 4th, which is the date the governor's moratorium on disconnections lifts. And the OUCC, the Consumer Protection Agency, also wants the commission to look into how utilities can best recover money lost due to things like unpaid bills, but doing so in a way that doesn't put an increased burden on consumers.
Okay, so it sounds like they're keeping a few plates in the air on this, but it seems like they're needing a little bit of help.
Yeah, the utility companies specifically are saying, hey, we're kind of getting hit on both sides, right? We have the lower demand for energy. We have people who aren't able to pay. And we're also then having to go a little bit above and beyond what we usually do. And consumer advocates are kind of in the opposite corner saying, hey, no, we totally get that. But also, we don't want to put an undue burden on people who are already struggling because of a global pandemic.
Understood. All right. Workforce training. What do we know?
Yeah, the governor's workforce cabinet is partnering with a nonprofit to provide workers with information about how the state's workforce ready grants for job certifications. It's the first step in a multi-agency job recovery plan the state is calling Rapid Recovery for a Better Future. And so this is essentially the state's first step to economic recovery through the lens of, you know, workforce. So workforce ready grants pay for tuition and fees to enroll in a community college job certification program. The state deems as having high value, which includes advanced manufacturing, health services and IT services. InvestEd typically advises Hoosiers on paying for college, but it's making 7 financial aid experts available to answer questions about the grant specifically.
Okay. So, yeah, using this time quite accordingly, it seems like, and we'll be ready once this all is kind of over with. All right. Let's look at the Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI and a study they recently did. What did they find?
Yeah. So this we talked about this a couple of weeks, maybe. I don't know. Time has no meaning. the state partnered with IUPUI to study how COVID-19 has moved throughout the state. So it's the Indiana Department of Health partnering with IUPUI. And so that study has yielded its initial results. And those results include an estimated 186,000 Hoosiers either have currently or had previously COVID-19.
Wow.
Yeah. The Fairbanks school tested 4,611 people around the end of April, randomly sampled to replicate the demographics of the state's population, and the prevalence of the disease was around 2.8%. One of the leads of the study says the data suggests that the stay-at-home order helped curb the spread of the virus and really contained it to individual households. And the Fairbanks study also suggests that nearly half of all Hoosiers who are positive for the virus don't show symptoms whatsoever.
Wow. 2.8%.
Mm-hmm.
186,000 Hoosiers have had. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very interesting estimate from the Fairbanks School of Public Health.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at some non-COVID-19 news, shall we?
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Some decidedly not COVID-19 news.
So, first, Attorney General Curtis Hill, we got some, I don't know, did the Supreme Court rule on this or what did they say?
Yeah. So his Attorney General Curtis Hill's law license was suspended by the Indiana Supreme Court. So there was an investigation from basically the ethics committee for attorneys in the state, and they presented this to the Supreme Court, which has the final say on what happens. And the court unanimously says Curtis Hill criminally battered four women at a party in March of 2018. Those allegations became public in July 2018, but a special prosecutor opted not to bring criminal charges, and a federal lawsuit by the four women was largely dismissed. But the state Supreme Court says while Hill committed misdemeanor battery worth a 30-day suspension, his actions after the allegations became public do not sufficiently indicate that he was without remorse, and so his license should be automatically reinstated. So at the end of the 30 days, which starts on Monday, he will automatically be reinstated as a lawfully operating attorney in the state, which also happens to be just a few days before the Indiana Republican Party's state convention is scheduled to vote on the GOP nominee for attorney general in this fall's election.
Good timing on their part, it seems like. All right. But real quick, what did the governor say about this?
Yeah, he wants clear guidance from the Supreme Court on Hill's future. There isn't a hard and fast rule as to what happens if an attorney general has his license suspended while he or she is operating in that position. So he wants some guidance on that. The Supreme Court sent out an email about 20 minutes ago that they are still in the process of making that decision.
Okay. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, which means she makes all the cool visuals for us on our online stories. And there's a lot of data to crunch these days. So she's been working extra hard for us. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to do this little radio show on Friday afternoons.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, if you miss live music, I have three guests who miss it even more. Three independent music venue owners from Indianapolis and Bloomington join me next to talk about a new alliance that they hope will keep them open after the pandemic. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The pandemic has disrupted nearly all aspects of public life, and one that a lot of people miss right now is one that directly affects the incomes of a host of professions, from musicians and roadies all the way to bartenders. Music venues will be quiet for a good while longer while we wait this out. And right now, we're talking specifically about independent music venues, small clubs that operate on thin margins. There are quite a few of them in Indiana, and they all need help. As a result, many of them came together to form the Indiana Independent Venue Alliance. I'm joined now by a few of their founding members. Dave Kubiak is the owner of the Bluebird in Bloomington. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon.
Dustin Boyer owns Duke's, a honky-tonk in Indianapolis. Hi, Dustin.
Howdy.
And Josh Baker is the owner of the Hi-Fi in Indianapolis, as well as the concert and event management group MOKB Presents. Welcome to you, Josh.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
So, Josh, before we get to the alliance and what you're planning to do, I think it's important to illustrate what the first few days of this pandemic looked like for you. And I'm sure that that your experience is echoed in the other two guests we have with us. What did you find yourself having to do?
You know, just a lot of uncertainty. You know, kind of thinking back to that day, I believe it was March 11th.
Yeah, that was the turning point.
that was the day it all changed. You know, we kind of felt it. Something was coming. We kind of knew there were some things, you know, bubbling, but that was the day the governor issued the mandated restriction orders. We had drive-by truckers at the Vogue, which were on stage sound checking at the time. Jay Roddy at the club and another show in the Lo-Fi. So three shows that same night. And I walked in the Vogue to sound check probably 5:30 right when that happened. And that was the moment when it all changed and we had to pull the band off stage and just start the process of rescheduling and rescheduling. We had a sold out camp show two nights later at the Vogue and it just, you know, just unraveled from there. And those first 3 weeks were just a constant of canceling, moving, you know, uncertainty with tour routings and, you know, just again, I guess uncertainty is probably the overused word, but I mean, it really was like none of us had been through this before. So you kind of make it up as you go. And, you know, it was a hard time. It still is. So.
Dave, what would you say independent music venues like yours, the Bluebird, bring to the community?
Well, we're kind of the cultural center for a lot of the small towns. So in Bloomington, a lot of people come to the Bluebird for shows from, you know, surrounding counties and surrounding cities. And so, you know, for the Bluebird, when the Bluebird has a concert, you know, the local restaurants are feeding off of us and the hotels, people come in town, stay the night at the hotel, have dinner. Maybe go have a beer before or after the show. And so a lot of it's interdependent on each other and rely on the prosperity of live shows.
Dustin, how long has your venue, Duke's, been around?
We celebrated our second anniversary under quarantine, so not very long.
Oh, my God. What was that like for you?
It's kind of bittersweet, you know. We're kind of hitting our stride on getting things going and, you know, starting to get some better acts in here and then just to be shut down and watch the place that I birthed celebrate its second with nobody in it.
Dave, I mean, the Bluebird's been around for a long time, but those first few years I imagine are the hardest. How hard are those first few years? Dukes has been around only two now.
Oh my gosh, really hard. So I've owned the Bluebird for 16 years. The Bluebird's been around for 47 years. But I can tell you as the first few years of ownership that those are critical. And a lot of small businesses don't make it in the first 5 years. And when you're starting out a small business, it's really tough. So I feel for the guys at Duke's that's got to be really a trying time.
Dustin, yeah, you rent your space, if I'm not wrong. Have you been given any kind of break there?
Yeah, our landlord's been really solid. He, throughout the month of April, we're negotiating the month of May and beyond right now. Really solid guy. He owns a lot. I mean, he owns the 49 acres that this property sits on. So he owns all the businesses, so he's struggling as well.
Yeah. Josh, I want to get kind of more of an idea of the business model of an independent venue. Can you share that with me? What kind of margins are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different for every room. You know, so with a club like Dustin's, you know, it's more percentages of the door of the ticket sales. And he's got different economics, too. He could probably elaborate on in terms of, you know, food. We don't serve really any food at the club. We're a concert venue. And so we are out there. I guess Dave and I probably align more. You know, there's guarantees. There's percentages of the ticket sales. The margin itself, by the time you pay the overhead and you factor in drink sales and all the other things, you know, you're lucky it's 20%. You know, some shows are more, some shows are less. But, you know, these are labors of love for us. You know, none of us are doing this because we, you know, it's a great business model. We do it because we love the shows and love the music. And there is money to be made in the business. It's been like this for years, you know. At this level, though, you know, to get the shows to get to your room, to attract those shows to the market, not only just to your own room, but to the city. We're competing with other markets to attract these shows. You have to put the money up front sometimes. And that is where, you know, the shows can go up or down. It's professional gambling is what I like to call it sometimes. But it's really it goes back to us being so passionate about the music and what we're doing. And that's okay with us. But when something like this happens, it really has a really massive impact, not only right now, you know, it's bad now, but our biggest concerns are what's it going to be like the next 6 months, you know, because folks are going to come back to work and offices and businesses and hair salons and things like that are going to restart. But, you know, I've lost, I've had 120, 130 shows affected. I lost 50, and my shows from August through December are now pushing to April of 2021. Mm. And there's not really enough local and regional shows to go around to fill the clubs, let alone my club. I mean, we have 30 Alliance members. How are we going to fill all those clubs in Indiana for the next 6 months? That's the biggest challenge right now.
Dave, I mean, 16 years in, when would you say you hit the stride on figuring out the business and where the money can go and how much of it you can, as the owner, take off the top?
Well, I had managed the club 8 or 10 years prior to that, so I had a pretty good understanding. But you have to be sometimes 5-6 years in before you start to get some sort of comfort level of, okay, this is, you know, you feel like you can take more risks on certain things and you really kind of hit your stride if this works or this doesn't work. But to alluding what Josh just said about our biggest concern, is one of the big things in our business is trying to project what things will be in 6 months. So right now in May, we are, you know, planning what are we going to do in November and what is the climate going to be like? Will this virus come back? Will people be going out? What types of people will be going out? And what will they pay? What kind of ticket price will they pay for a certain show? And we have to make those determinations now for 4, 5, 6, 7 months out. And that's a really tough question right now, you know, but we need to make those decisions and project, you know, what types of shows are going to work in the future for us.
We're talking to the owners of some independent music venues in Indiana. Dave Kubiak is the owner of the Bluebird in Bloomington. Josh Baker is the owner of the Hi-Fi in Indianapolis, as well as MOKB Presents. Dustin Boyer owns Duke's Honky Tonk in Indianapolis that just celebrated its 2-year anniversary under quarantine. So, Dustin, I'm sure that when you got into this, you knew all of that. You knew that this was going to be a tough couple of years, and this has just obviously made it harder. I don't know. How do you feel about reopening?
It's really uncertain at this time. You know, we just got to a stride where I didn't have to bartend 6 nights a week on top of booking the shows and cooking the meals. It's a tough call if we're going to make it out of this thing alive. I hope that we do. But our room is small. It's an under 200 capacity room. And so getting folks to come out and see what we're doing, you know, we're a really niche market. We only do country music. So we're the smallest of the small. We got our fingers crossed that everything turns out all right. But just like everybody else, we're trying to project what's going to happen November, December, January, and what's next.
And have you, as I understand it, the other two venues don't really have much going on right now in the realm of making money, but it sounds like you do food as well. Have you been doing any carry out or anything like that? And I mean, how has that been for you? Has that been enough at all?
Yeah, we started doing a little bit of fried chicken carry out. We do it 2 days a week. Started out real hot and heavy. It was selling out every weekend. Now it's kind of tapering off. So this is actually our last week to do the fried chicken. We're going to switch it up and maybe start doing some barbecue a couple days a week. Just something to try to help. You know, when my landlord comes back and says he needs his rent, we can pay it.
Josh, so tell me about the formation of the Indiana Independent Venue Alliance. When did it become clear that this was going to be necessary?
You know, the thought was in our head back about a year and a half, 2 years ago when we did this Indianapolis music strategy. We talked with some folks from the UK about what they do over there and thought it would be a great idea. And it just kind of fell by the wayside. And then I think probably a week into this, I was calling around just to talk to, you know, I know Dustin, he's a buddy. I know Kubiak, you know, I know the guys at the Melody Inn. We all kind of are, you know, running that same professional circle. So just checking in on people and, you know, the temperature that I got was that there was just, you know, getting back to that uncertainty, kind of, what do I do? We were all in the same boat. And so I just said, well, let's get us on a call and let's talk out, you know, our problems. And like, I don't know, guys, well, the first one was maybe about 8 of us, I think. And we just on that call decided, well, let's put together this alliance and make it official. and see what we can do, because we, you know, we kind of saw how bad it was going to be. And then the National Independent Venue Association, which goes by NEVA, had formed about a week earlier, which is now up to about, I think, 1,500 members. So they're really focused on lobbying efforts and getting some federal aid set aside for these venues across the country. And then we looked at that locally and said, well, we have our own set of challenges here locally that we could kind of coalesce all of our whole group together, work on these things, you know, as a team, and then kind of run alongside what they're doing on the national level. So, I mean, this has only been, I want to say it's been 4 weeks since we really officially formed. I think we've had about four calls amongst us, and now we're up to 30, 35 members, and, you know, have a lot of steam and a lot of momentum.
Well, time is of the essence, of course, and so it makes sense that it has grown this quickly, this fast. So, Josh, if you could distill the mission of the Alliance down for us, I guess, what would it be?
Well, I think, you know, providing emergency relief for these venues is number one. There's not really anything out there for them. And we're really focused on what's about to happen in the fall. So everything that we're doing right now is setting our sights on propping us up for the fall so that we've got a safety net out there. And then on top of that, we're going out and pulling in educational resources for our rooms. On Monday, we're going to have one of the top insurance, event insurance companies on a call with all of us to kind of give us some best practices and, you know, kind of continue to educate our members on the right and wrong ways to do things, what other things are happening in the industry that we should be paying attention to. And then also setting aside opportunities for some of the employees, like the production staff and the artists, which are probably the number one member of our, you know, are kind of our live music ecosystem is the artists. So I think down the road, there's a couple of things that we want to really attack from a policy standpoint once we become a little more organized. But, you know, I'm blown away with how much we pulled together in 4 weeks. And I think that just goes to show that we've got a lot of really smart business owners in these clubs and leaders that are willing to join together and do this. And I think what we're doing right now is going to change things, you know, 5-10 years from now. We're going to look back at this and go, I'm really glad we did that.
Dustin, I mean, you're in a really tough spot right now. What will you need this alliance to do for you?
I mean, I think it's a great community, brothers and sisters banding together and, you know, a little bit of leaning on everybody to see, you know, we're about to switch how we bid for shows. Like, we don't know if people are going to come out. We can't take those risks and give the guarantees up that we want to give up. So just kind of feeling everybody out and make sure we're all in the same boat. And, you know, hopefully I never have to use any relief funds, but if we do, it'd be nice to know that they're around.
And so those relief funds, I know it's really, really hard to predict the future right now. It's an exercise in futility almost. But, you know, if the rent does come due, how much do you think you'll need to take?
I mean, that's a question to be determined. We're very fortunate that, you know, we have our bills paid and there's a little bit of money in the bank. We're trying not to wreck that. You know, that's so uncertain. I can't answer that.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I think from an alliance standpoint, you know, again, this just goes back to how fast we're running. You know, in most situations, you'd have a board of directors and a, you know, your whole team put together before you did this. And we're kind of working backwards. And we're fortunate enough, we've actually just added a couple really, really incredible board members. And once we get that board in place, you know, us as venue owners will kind of take a different role, and then we'll have that board kind of run point for us in determining kind of how those funds will be distributed amongst the alliance. Again, that's something that's kind of unfolding each day now that we've only been fundraising for, you know, probably about a week now. And we'll be starting our full campaign on Sunday.
Well, and that's sort of, I mean, throwing things together quickly is something that you as venue owners are used to for certain. Now, let's talk about the stream that's happening on Sunday. Who's playing?
Oh, man, we've got all kinds of artists playing. Houndmouth, Matt Quinn from Mount Joy, Duran Jones, Otis Gibbs and Amy Lashley, Chris Caraba from Dashboard Confessional.
Wow.
Local artists from High Rider to Molly June, just really an incredible lineup of artists, and they're all kind of really handpicked because they've got some unique ties to these stages. The program itself is a 2-hour special that really is built to raise awareness for these venues across the state. And I think when you see it and you see the faces behind these rooms and you hear the stories and you see the connection to the artist and how the artists feel about them, it kind of reminds you as a fan too, that, you know, why you like that place. You know, we're neighbors, we're music curators, we're your friends. And I think everybody has their own little circle around their favorite venue. And that really kind of comes through in this video. And I think it's really touching, and it's a fundraiser for us. I mean, folks can be able to donate during the program too. And that those different local companies and corporations will be matching donations throughout the program. But the program itself is something I think as an alliance we're very, very proud of, and being able to pull it together in less than 2 weeks, all remotely, nonetheless. And kudos to our producer, Matt Mays, who's a three-time Emmy winner. He's really jumped in and volunteered his time to put this thing together. And I don't recall ever seeing anything in this market that really showcases the music like this piece does. So we hope everybody can tune in.
Well, it's called Till We Meet Again, a tribute to the Writers and the Rooms, and it streams on Sunday at 6 p.m., Sunday, May 17th. Josh Baker is the owner of the Hi-Fi in Indianapolis, as well as the concert and event venue, event management group MOKB Presents. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Dave Kubiak owns the Bluebird in Bloomington. Thanks for your time, Dave.
Thanks so much.
And Dustin Boyer owns Dukes in Indianapolis. Best of luck, Dustin.
Appreciate it, Matt. Thank you.
And again, the live stream is Sunday at 6. You can see it at the Indiana Independent Venue Alliance's website, indianavenuealliance.org. Up next, the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site in Indianapolis has been 3D scanning many artifacts from their collection for a unique online experience that has come in quite handy now that we can't actually visit the museum. I'll talk to their president about the new digital archive next. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site in downtown Indianapolis has hundreds of artifacts from before, during, and after the 23rd U.S. President's time in office, as well as pieces from 20 other presidents. Well, since many of us have been unable to visit the site, they've offered up much of their collection virtually, and they have a pretty unique way of letting you explore some of the most significant items in the collection. They've been 3D scanned, so you can turn and rotate the item to inspect it from all angles, zoom in and zoom out. Here to talk with us is Charlie Hyde. He's the president and CEO of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. Charlie, welcome.
Thank you, Matt.
So how long has this been a feature at your website?
Well, you know, it's something that's actually been long underway. So I would say that it started off as a philosophical approach and has evolved into just a really tremendous way to engage the general public, educators, students, enthusiasts with our collection. So for those of your listeners that have actually had a chance to go through the museum before, it's 10,000 square feet. We've got over 10,000 artifacts. It's a National Historic Landmark. It's a really tremendous collection surrounding the life of an American president. So to give you some context, you know, if you look at Monticello, they've got about 6,000 items in their collection, for Mount Vernon, about 10,000 in theirs. So again, to have a collection of this significance right here in central Indiana is tremendous. And so it was really important to us to think about the ways that we could share our collection, beyond a visit. And what that meant for us was, thinking about beyond the exhibit, beyond the tour, beyond even just flat pictures of this collection, really just being very thoughtful about how we could share that more broadly. So for us, this process started really 4 or 5 years ago, and we had reached out to partners at IUPUI, University Library and the Center for Digital Scholarship, and friends at the School of Informatics, and had shared this idea for how we envisioned a museum collection to be shared. So this is right at the very cutting edge of this technology, making this feasible. And so we started going through that process, and it takes time, especially for a museum, to be able to identify the partners and the resources, to really make this happen. So we were fortunate that we had supportive supportive underwriting from the RBNS Educational Foundation in digitizing the collection, and had great support from other funders and finding ways to make that more accessible. But the long and short of it is then that we've been able to build up almost 100 items from our collection, so very carefully curated items from our collection that we can share in this way. So for your listeners that are more familiar with, you know, Googling, looking for images of things, you know, it's very commonplace to be able to find pictures or, you know, that 2D perspective on objects or paintings. With a 3D technology, what it actually allows you to do is to see it in the round. So it's very much like being there in person. So going to our website at presidentbenjaminharrison.org, being able to pull up some of these items from the collection, you get to look at it in that more conventional 2D way. But from there, the technology takes over, and it's really user-friendly. So we're very intentional in finding a tool that would allow somebody without a lot of technological expertise to be able to essentially just click and drag. And Matt, you may have had a chance to do this yourself, but being able to spin these objects around, to enlarge them, to shrink them, to look at the fine detail, it's just a really extraordinary perspective, again, on these nationally significant artifacts.
I did. I looked at the, William Henry Harrison's boot jack. And I looked, because I thought that was such a sort of simple item, and obviously a very old one as well, since it was William Henry Harrison's. Also the piano. I thought, how did they scan a huge piano? How did you scan some of these larger items, the furniture and things like that?
So part of it is just having a vision for how we can share this collection, but it's also having great partners working alongside. So as an organization, we've challenged ourselves to become, you know, one of the most innovative, impactful, and civically engaged presidential sites in the country. We've been able to do that in a number of ways. And I would say this is just one of those ways that, again, we're continuing to push the envelope, trying to rethink the way that museums can engage with the world. And you know, again, it comes back to really making sure that people have access to this collection. So it's about democratizing the collection. So if there's a gripe that people have with museums sometimes, it's that maybe they're too restrictive and letting people actually see what they have behind closed doors. And putting up access walls or paywalls to being able to see and utilize things that they have in their collection. So what we've done is we've basically just pulled down all those walls, and where, you know, some museums want to tell you no, we want to tell you yes. Where some museums would tell you don't touch the artifacts, we're saying here's a way that you can engage directly with these artifacts. We're not trying to hide our collection away. We want it open and accessible to the world. And so not only can you look at these artifacts, if you have access to a 3D printer, whether at home, in your school, in a makerspace, you can actually download and 3D print from this collection too. So we've really worked to pull all barriers down from access to this collection. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, we're working years out on this. We never anticipated a global pandemic. As I think few people really did that would ever come to where we are right now. But what an extraordinary time to be able to enrich the educational opportunities for students, for educators, again, for enthusiasts, to be able to access this material at a time when physically they're just not able to.
I know that it's possible to 3D print some of these items from the data that you have uploaded to the website. But have you heard of anyone actually doing it?
Yes. In fact, you know, it's one of the exciting things that I can't officially announce, and my staff are going to give me dirty looks on this for even mentioning it. But we're preparing to launch for a crowd printing of Benjamin Harrison in life size. So we actually have the prototype website ready, where you can check out pieces. And so our aim is going to be to engage schools and universities in this effort to be able to download and 3D print these individual pieces from a life-size Benjamin Harrison. So this is actually utilizing a maquette that was made in preparation for the Benjamin Harrison Memorial that's on New York Street next to the Federal Building downtown. So that's an initiative that we'll be launching officially later this year. But again, it's another way to be able to rethink these collection items, to recognize that there's also some project-based learning where it can engage with school projects that have like a stronger STEM background, and just ensure that we're continuing to remain relevant and engaged in this educational process.
We're talking with the president and CEO of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, Charlie Hyde, about their online collection, which is 3D scanned, and you can go online and you can turn the objects and look at them from all different angles. It is fascinating. I'm wondering technically how you did this. I mean, this has been kind of a process over a few years, and we've gone into that a little bit. But what went into getting this actually done?
Again, it comes down to having the right partners. So, you know, you look at the way that different organizations are structured, and I think that we're very fortunate and that we have a long tradition of building, finding, building, and growing strong partnerships.
I'm curious, though, what it looks like when an item is being scanned.
Well, so Matt, it's interesting because it's as close to magic as I think you can come with technology in someone's hand. It's a fascinating process. In fact, we had this open to the public as we were going through some of the scanning process, where we had our partners from the university on site scanning artifacts. And as tours were going through, visitors could actually see this process underway. And so there's a handheld handheld scanner. It looks for all the world like one of those grocery scanners, you know, that you would run over barcodes. But again, you know, approaching the threshold of magic, and one hand holding up this scanner, and then you see a computer screen adjacent to you where you have a physical object seemingly materializing out of thin air.
Wow.
And tandem with the scanner going over it and recognizing that this combination of history and technology and kind of philosophy of how a collection should be shared, all intersecting in these objects and the way they're being scanned is just phenomenal. So it really is a kind of a magical process to see how it comes into play and the technology that's being utilized to make it accessible.
I was picturing a chamber of some kind that you would place the object in, but no, it's literally just like a hand scanner, huh?
Well, and Matt, it's interesting because there are lots of different ways that artifacts could be scanned and capturing them this way. So the outcome tends to be the same, and that it creates essentially an engineering file. Mm. But there are lots of different mechanisms that can be used. And we happened upon, I think, a way that was maximum efficiency, that did the best job capturing the artifacts as true to life as possible. And so while it's not preservation in itself, it does help us document the condition of those artifacts in this moment of time. And, you know, it certainly meets the charge that we have as stewards of this nationally significant collection and finding ways to be able to share it well beyond our doors. So it's become a globally accessible collection in one fell swoop. And that's important to us and certainly within the larger mission that we have.
I have to ask, do you have any favorites in the digital collection? Maybe something that you would suggest that we start with?
Well, if I can answer that question by way of a story. So it's been really important to us to try to find the kind of the greater significance of being able to share a collection like this. And as important it is for us to put it out there for the world to discover, we also wanted to make sure that we were providing in a format that would be relevant and I'll say actionable. So we had reached out to the Indiana School for the Blind and Visually Impaired to partner on a pilot program. And so in working with their leadership and teachers and students, we actually piloted a program with them last year, literally putting this collection in the hands of their students. So being able to actually go out to the school and with our education team, and being able to print off a selection of 5 of the objects from the collection for each of the students to have in their own touch box before they came on site for a visit. So for each of these students to learn about the American presidency and get some perspective on American history through these 5 objects that each of them got before them, and getting to hold it in their hands, to talk about that greater legacy and history, everything from the Centennial Cane, which is truly one of my favorites. It's a fantastic folk art piece that has all the presidents from George Washington through Benjamin Harrison carved into it, to kind of a delightful caricature of Benjamin Harrison that was carved by a family friend that is fairly close to round. Benjamin Harrison was not that round. It was a little rotund. But you could see just from the selection of artifacts that it really gave a broad, a diverse perspective on our collection, and for their students to be able to gain that greater context hands-on before they came and visited the museum and had that on-site context. So we hope that for the general public, that's something that they themselves might take full advantage of. So, you know, while many of our arts and culture organizations are closed to the public because of the limitations of the current stay-at-home order and, you know, just with the global pandemic, this is a great opportunity to be able to explore collections. Not just ours. I mean, you know, look at the great arts and cultural organizations across the community, you know, go to their websites, look at what resources they have available. But for ours specifically, you know, to be able to look at this new tool with the 3D imaging and to be able to see things, you know, very fully in the round and just kind of to come to life before your eyes.
Charlie, I'm so glad we have you right now because I want to ask this. We right now are in a pretty historic moment. How can history, the kind of history that you offer with the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, how can history comfort us or show perspective right now?
You know, that's a great question, Matt. And I would characterize it as a very much a history book moment. So it's something that we should all be very mindful of, that history truly has its eyes on us. And so it's not just a matter of just reacting, but we need to be very thoughtful and purposeful about how we're all moving forward with these challenges. I mean, it's a little bit like a 100-year flood right now. You think about the last global pandemic was 1918. And, you know, while you can find some comfort, you know, looking at history and knowing that this too shall pass, also look for guidance. And I think it's one of the ways that we as a presidential site have greater relevance and value to the community is, you know, whether it's Benjamin Harrison's story and that important legacy that he has, you know, in conservation and African American voting rights. You can look to these stories from history and try to gain greater perspective on the challenges we're facing today. And I think that's one of the, you know, points of comfort. If you can find comfort in this moment, it's that that the world has been through challenging times before, that that we've found solutions to some of those challenges, and it's just important for us to glean what we can from the past. You know, so certainly we're avoiding some of the mistakes that have been made in the past, but charting a course and in a way that, you know, as history is looking back on us 10, 20, 50 years from now, they'll see that we've acted in good faith. They'll see that we acted with integrity and that we're doing what's best for our community.
We've been talking with the president of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, which is now featuring 3D scans of several of their most significant artifacts at their website, presidentbenjaminharrison.org. And Charlie Hyde, thank you so much for this online archive, and thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks, Matt, so much, and all the best to you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Catch up if you have some time. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.